107.7 and 105.3 from New Orleans.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to FICA. Our guest today is Helen J.R. Bruce. She is the author of The Heat of the Hunt, a folkloric fairy tale, and Lie of the Land, the first two books in her Heat of the Hunt trilogy. She is also a folklorist and an illustrator. That's who Helen is. But I think what Helen is magical. She can weave the strands of her story through a mist so real that you'll find yourself reaching for a sweater. Her talent for creating atmospheric settings not only has you reading about joining friends for a pint at the pub, but actually feeling like you're with them, having one. I've never physically been to Dartmoor or the UK, in fact, but if I ever get a chance to visit, I'm sure I will be haunted by a sense of deja vu, but hopefully not haunted by the Wild Hunt, because all magic isn't twinkly. Thank you for creating such a mystical world for us to travel to, Helen, and welcome to FICA.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I'm excited because when I read your first book, I wrote to you and said, I just wanted to stand up and say, bravo, bravo. Like, I was just so impressed for a first book. And then of course I didn't highlight any of my sections, so I can never find them in a book again afterwards. I was writing through it today. So for those who haven't read your book and are not saying bravo yet, can you tell us a little bit about Heat of the Hunt and what it is that inspired you to write it?
So the whole Heat of the Hunt trilogy really is, as you can probably tell, it's a bit of a love letter from me to Dartmoor and to British folklore. And I had the pleasure of spending, you know, over 10 years visiting the locations and researching and, you know, going to the pubs and walking the moors and hearing the stories, sometimes firsthand. So I wanted to collect all of this amazing folklore sort of in one place in a way that was accessible to a modern reader. It was exciting, it was fast-paced, it was fun, and people could read the story and then maybe feel inspired to research some more of the folklore themselves, or even visit some of the many locations, because all of the locations in the books are all real places that you can go to.
Yeah, or just even if you can't make it there, you can look up, I looked up, the national park and the images from there, and Tor was exactly how I imagined it from your writing. Like, I saw the picture and I saw the little name and I was like, oh look, I've been there in a book. So it really is a beautiful place, and the ponies really do run free there.
So Dartmoor is covered in livestock. It's not wild per se, although livestock is owned, but it roams, various animals roam over the moor. So you will see cattle, you'll see Highland cattle, you'll see lots of sheep, and you'll see the ponies as well if you're out walking.
I feel there is always hope for a world in which ponies run free. It's there's a lot of happiness to that. I'm not sure I would want to walk up close to one of the Highland cattle, though. They look a little intimidating.
The large horns, yeah. Always, I think, with cows, you know.
You never know.
The distance.
It's a smart thing to do. So you obviously love this land, and you have this beautiful background with all these stories attached to it, and you brought it to modern day. How can you tell us, without giving too much away, this is very difficult to do, you don't want to give spoilers, but we want to entice our fellow readers to check this book out. So you go.
So I guess the Heat of the Hunt trilogy It's been described as a modern fairy tale unlike any other. I was delighted. I love reading reviews. And I read a really lovely review where someone was saying that they'd read a lot of books sort of about the fae and influenced by folklore and similar themes. And they'd found that the stories had become a little bit formulaic, I think, because there are certain archetypes, maybe very quite interesting, very alluring to write about. But maybe if you read many, many, many of this type of genre of books, you might find you're coming across similar stories, which is fine. You know, in some way, that's quite a comfort.
It's a genre thing that happens, right?
Yeah, it's a thing that happens. And for a great comfort read, you know, that's just lovely sometimes. But I did want to try and do something a bit different with my take on folklore. It's as close to reality as I can get it. So the characters are complex. We don't have, you know, just good, just evil. And there's many layers of, you know, right and wrong. So it's not just a simple hero quest. It's got more gray areas, I guess, than that, which makes
it real. It's extraordinarily real. Like, I think I've hung out with Adrian, you know, I felt like Gemma, like just frustrated. It is extraordinarily real. And I think that's when we get into genres and there's so many books being written, it is easy to not even knowing rewrite. But because your characters are so real and human, even if they're not, it is. Bravo. I agree with her. It is definitely something different. Something. It's honest. It's straightforward. It's like you knew your folklore so well that you were able to just go with the story from there. It was just a natural thing, I think.
It's true. I have characters, and I know we touched on Clara in the second book.
I was trying to find that passage, and I can't. But
oh, I love her. she's, you know, this middle-aged woman. She's retired. She's decided she's going to get into witchcraft really late in life, and she's just brilliant. She summons the demon huntsman with a slightly off steak. No, it's not. It's a pork chop. It's even worse. So it sticks. And I love her. And I created her as a character. She was meant to just appear and just be killed, you know? Well, that's giving ignore that. It's giving away. But anyway, she doesn't. She refused. My baddie, you know, Cabell wouldn't kill her. Bear in mind his character. He was like, she's a witch. I'm not killing her. And she was just like, no. So she's all in that book. She's going to be in the third book.
Yeah, so that's not a spoiler because we know she's going to be in the third book, and it's not. I mean, it might take a little tension. I don't think I never really felt like she was a goner because she was just possibly just a little too oblivious to what was going on. I brought that up because further on, and we can return to that and the story because nothing is ever organized here at FICA. I said that Clara is a good example for theme, as I mentioned earlier, that not all magic is twinkly. And so you don't have much time to learn when you get involved with an evil an evil entity. So you sort of have to learn quickly and do what you have to do in that moment to, you know, catch up to what's been going on around you. So maybe if you're out there summoning things, you might want to just make sure that you've had a little more experience, right?
I mean, yeah, she was, one minute she was just trying to do a little love spell. The next minute, you know, she was in way too deep. But I just love how she keeps her little book of teenage witchcraft spells in her bra. You know,
because you never know, and that's the book that she had, and she was quite the problem solver because she could change the spells for for other things.
This is hope for the best.
But yeah, if anybody reads the book and they get to the Etsy line, like, just call me, message me, Facebook me. I need to laugh with somebody that, because yeah, I think there's a little bit of Clara in all of us, or we at least know a Clara. Like, she just is a wonderful character. Now, I don't know, at the end of book two, I'm not sure where she's going with that and how I'm going to feel with her about her in book three. But you know, you do need to have those characters that create change, and she does.
Clara makes terrible life decisions, and she continues that. That's all about
that affect everyone. She helps out too. We love Clara. So you have your protagonist, which is someone who is not a great believer, and is just, you know, associated with another. I mean, very much. There are the people in the book who want the magic. Like, they want the magic. They want it to happen. They just don't want to learn about magic or whatever. They want the magic and the things that they create. So definitely the be careful what you wish for kind of thing is happening there. You have the non-believers that are just, you know, going along because they're good friends and everything and get caught up in everything. And you have the magical people themselves that are involved and creating this kind of thing. So I've gone on and on, and I'll still continue to go on and on, and how wonderful your atmosphere creating is. How much do you think that was your love and your experience of being there, or do you think you're just amazing? Those are the only two choices I can come up with at the moment.
No. I think you just cannot underestimate the importance, if you can, when you're writing, or visiting somewhere for real and spending time there and really letting a place sink in to you. Because spending that time getting to know a place, truly know it, not just maybe from pictures online or from reading about it. I think once you have that intimate knowledge of a place, then you can write very honestly about the atmosphere, about what it feels like, what it smells like, what it looks like, in a way that you don't have to make up. You're recounting very much a real place. And I think perhaps in the writing that comes through.
Yeah, no, I think it did, because it was all the senses being used, and it was, like, honestly, I'm not usually wordless, but no, it was definitely like you were there. And I feel like your having been there so often and loving that created that through your words. And possibly, do you think the fact that you're also an illustrator, an artist, would influence your way of thinking in that way?
Potentially. I think a lot of people who are creative have many avenues of their creativity. So when I go for a walk, if I go on to Dartmoor and I am going to maybe walk to a new place or see somewhere, I do like to take pictures as I walk as well. So I will keep a stash of pictures, which I can then refer back to. And I will be aware of perhaps, you know, the colours and the textures and capturing that.
Right.
So yeah, there's probably something in that, but then I'd say a lot of us have that eye maybe for
remembering. Oh yeah, there is, and there is. We talked about your initials and J.R. Tolkien. There is lovely descriptions, but perhaps some of those who have gone before went a little too far in descriptions, which leads some of us that don't like to admit it, going ahead, like, you know, five pages to get past the mountain or whatever.
Oh, the skim read.
to get to the dialogue and the action. But you don't do that. It is definitely in the moment along with the story. And so you can, I don't know. I've never been to Dartmoor, but I could smell the earth and, you know, wanting to have a hot tea, and you're sitting there saying you still go walking out there. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you better be home by dark, because there's a lot going on there after dark.
It's true. I haven't even spoken to anyone about this. I had the weirdest experience in Dartmoor recently. I went with a friend to the edge of Wiseman's Wood, which is obviously mentioned in the book. It's on the cover of the first edition. So that's
right, which is your illustration. I never got that one up over the week.
This is the first. These are all gone now. So they're replaced by the new cover. But Wiseman's Wood is basically this 500-plus-year-old patch of woodland of these stunted oaks in Dartmoor with all boulders in between. With this amazing boulder with a swirl on, can you see behind him? There's like a swirl.
Yes, yes.
And there's moss on this boulder that's been carved into a swirl. It's amazing. But during lockdown, too many people went there, so you can't go in anymore. So you walk around the edge. But I was walking around the edge of there, and I left it a bit late, and darkness did start to fall. And I had the weirdest experience of, I thought my friend had like their camera and was taking a picture behind me, these weird flashes of light. They were really disorientating. And it kept happening to the point I was sort of like, if I had been on my own, I feel I would have got lost. Because it was disorienting you. Yeah, I couldn't see properly where I was going. Every time this light went off, I lost my night vision. And luckily my friend was there. And as we got away from the woods, eventually it stopped. But thinking about it, all I could say is, you know, people say they've been pixie led or been disorientated by these lights.
There it was.
Maybe. I cannot explain. It was so bright, like a camera flash.
Well, first of all, as a mother that is much older than you as a mother, I would like to say, do not ever go out there by yourself. Luckily, my friend was there. Don't go out there without a friend, okay?
Everyone listening, just don't walk on Dartmoor with a friend.
No. So, and have you gone back since then?
Yes, but not to that area. I went somewhere else in the middle of a very sunny day.
Okay. All right. That sounds good to me. Okay.
That was good.
Now I can breathe. No, Helen. Now you're going to be getting emails. No, I won't. I'll let you be free. So we've gotten way off a track because at the beginning, we're back to center. We're coring it here. Can you tell us, because we talk about this folklore, the book is about the wild hunt and the huntmaster's hounds. Can you tell us the folklore behind that? So it won't be the story, but just the story behind the story.
So the folklore about the wild hunt is almost a whole, okay, it's more than a whole talk in itself. But the most fascinating parts about it, I guess, we have this recurring motif in the UK of the wild hunt. We get a lot of it in Welsh folklore with the Mabinogion. And our version of it here is they're generally sort of okay. If you cross their path, if you, you know, cover your eyes, you don't look, or you throw yourself on the ground, you're probably going to be okay. They're going to pass you by. Some of the other versions, so like the Norse versions where Odin leads the wild hunt, you're in trouble. If you the path with them, you know, you're prey. That's the end of that. But the UK version we have here, they're more just the role of a psychopomp, so a soul guide. So on certain days throughout the year, around Halloween or Samhain, sometimes just after Yule, around New Year, and on other days as well sometimes, They will go out and they will ride across the land and they will gather up any souls stuck on this plane who haven't passed on, and they will lead them on to the other world. So they have, you know, a very useful function. But they're also quite scary. And depending on, you know, the version of folklore you read, probably just not the kind of entities you want to overly mess with unless you really know what you're doing.
Especially if they're in a mood.
If they're in a bad mood, if they've been angered, you know, it's not a good sign.
Yeah, I think regardless of where I am, I think the best idea is just to do the drop, okay? Even if it's over, you don't want to see it coming. So, you know, Odin, do what you want, but I will be unaware, right?
Risking offending the Fae, you know, in so many stories. And the Wild Hunt have this weird crossover. So are they Fae? Are they gods? Are they the undead? They occupy sort of so many blurred lines across, you know, just they have so much capacity to mess with you, I think.
Well, it's like you said, in Norse tradition is Odin, which is a god, right? But then if you go to other places that are more fairy-oriented, the she or whatever, you have guys, whatever you want to be called, that's going to lean more in that direction, right?
And then just to complicate that, you have figures like Gwyn ap Nith, who originally in Mabinogion was more like a god, and then he's become diminished over time and now is often described as the king of the fairies. So it's fascinating, but complex.
Yes, you have. Now, Brian is back. Brian is a regular, and he is in investigative mood. He would like to know if your friend also saw those flashes of light.
No, they were not affected. Hence, I was going, did you see that light? And I thought they were messing with me. I was like, are you using your phone flash behind me? Have you got the torch on your phone? And they were like, no. So no, whatever it was only happening to me.
Well, I think that people that you have written about in the past are getting impatient and they're saying, get that third book done. Yes, that's how I'm interpreting it. So,
okay, would you write much quicker if you were captive for a while?
That's right. Take your water. Did you take your water with you out there?
No.
I don't even know. So that is the Wild Hunt itself. And the Huntmaster. Now, I'm going to say this wrong probably. This is what happens when you read people, you don't hear the words. The Wish Towns?
Yeah, close enough. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So that one worked. So few do. So they sort of like the whole Black Dog folklore thing sort of has its own thing separate from the that. And you actually have a story recorded in the British Museum of Finland of Black Dog. So do you want to tell us a little bit about the whole Black Dog thing?
Yes. So Black Dog folklore is its own thing as well. And again, it occurs all over the world. There's even Black Dog stories in America. There aren't as many, but I have read. Around the Great Lakes, you have a black dog, apparently. But we have the church.
Whereabouts about? Do you know whereabouts? I'm sorry to interrupt. I just got excited.
No, that's fine. I'm trying to, because I don't know America that well, but I will send you a link for exactly where I found the story. But
okay. I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Specific haunting, and it follows the same pattern as kind of the UK or some of the UK ones, where basically there was a black dog on a ship and it fell off and it got stuck in one of the like the gates, the lock gate system, and the crew weren't very pleasant and they didn't fish it out and it drowned. And basically it haunts the Great Lakes and appears on boats and scares people, and it's a bad omen.
I would think so.
And we get many variants, or we have Black Shuck in the UK, and you'll hear him maybe padding behind you, or you'll see him on a country lane, and you know he's a bad sign. He's often an omen of death, whether for you or for someone you know. But then we also have guardian black dogs. So in Somerset, where I live, we have the Gert dog, who appears as a black dog in the Mendip Hills and actually guides travellers who've got lost, especially children, down the hills to safety. So again, the black dog has got this very dual personality.
Personality. And I think that's important for us to point out, as a lot of people tend to think of these myths as in the black cat thing, and they don't want to have anything to do with them, because I've always had black cats, and my last two dogs were black, and they were wonderful creatures. Now I have one that looks dual, a cat, black and white, and she's who she is, okay? Just that way. But yes, we should not take that into consideration when adopting. But it is, I would love to hear the Great Lakes story. And it is interesting how much they have their own, it's sort of like stories behind them, the black dog. And honestly, I do not want to see a black dog in Dartmoor. It was just too real. So you mentioned that this is the second edition of your book, the one that I read. And one of the differences is that you have an introduction done by I can't remember everything off by heart, and I have these cards, and they don't ever follow where I want them to be at the time. Mark Norman, thank you. Okay, so they did an introduction by Mark Norman, who is the author of Black Dog Folklore and Dark Folklore, and the creator of the Folklore Podcast, who I may be trying to talk to later, because I'm just into this old black dog thing. So he did an introduction for your next edition. And he said, which I took because it's exactly, so I know that I'm not the only person noticing this. He said, honestly, Vicky, he said, I told you, I've got to keep it all in my head or it's gone. He said that, there's only six pages here. It's got to be here. That's page four. People, you're used to me. Just we're going to do this. Okay, I'll find it. He just says that you're really great at writing about the landscape as well, and he's lived through there. So we can believe what she says. But it was a lovely introduction. Now, did you go back and make any other changes?
Not overly. So as I was saying before, the first edition, it felt really important for me to illustrate it as well. So the cover is something that I painted, which is cool. But yeah, I wanted to go for something, I don't know, maybe a little bit more modern looking for the second edition, and also have a girl on the front rather than boy.
Yeah, because the main character is a girl, and sometimes we just like to see that, to feel like we can be the hero too, and we can do that. All the guys were just causing trouble. No, they had them. Okay, Brian is asking. I'm going to put you up here today, Brian. Okay, Brian is asking, are those black dogs separate entities or reflections, instances of the same one?
This is a juicy topic. We could lose many hours to this. I would say, from my research and from what I've encountered and what I've seen, we very much have regional black dogs in the UK. And they will have different, slightly different names, very slightly different characteristics, depending on which area of the country they're found. So it's within the same umbrella of folklore, but they are separate within that. And going back to the idea of the Church Grim, the concept of that is that when a new churchyard was built, the first thing buried in it was believed to have to protect all of the other later burials from the influence of the devil. And a person wasn't up to the task, or maybe
they just didn't cut it.
Yeah, they didn't cut it. Maybe it didn't feel right for it to be a person. I think the truth is a person wouldn't have cut it. So the first thing buried in a new graveyard in the northern part would be a black dog. And the spirit of the black dog would then stay in that churchyard and become the church grim. So a church grim is very much a local, it's like a localized entity attached to a particular graveyard.
So they're a protector.
So a church grim is a protector. That is their role. But again, it's nuanced because this creature has potentially, you know, been killed, been sacrificed and buried. You could easily question, how does it feel towards people? But I think it seems to be, it's very much focused on is protecting its space, its graveyard, its territory. So if you're perceived in any way as a threat, even if that might be, you know, you're walking too close to the graveyard late at night, like any other guard dog, a living guard dog, the church grim may see fit to see you off.
And then you have the number of hounds that are in the wild hunt itself. There are several dogs right there, not just one of them, but several.
So in my story, there's 9. I don't recall having read instances in folklore where it's particularly said exactly how many. Trying to think back. Odin might have a set number. But in many of the stories, there'll be other animals and strange creatures following on as well. But I decided to have 9 just because of the symbolism of the number, the magical meaning behind it. And it was also a number that I could envisage and show in the story, and they're each named.
Right. You could give them all personalities. But if you had 20, that would start to become difficult.
Yeah, well, Cabell, the demon huntsman in the second book, he has foxhounds and he has 40, 50 hounds.
But they're not individual.
They're not named. They're just a massive hound.
Because we don't care about them and we don't care if they get killed. We will care if the wished hounds get killed. That's what happens when you name them. I found my quote, so I feel justified now. What Mark Norman said was, Helen paints a literary picture of the moor in all of its splendor and majesty. And I thought that described it perfectly. So it's not just my opinion, people. other people agree. Okay, we'll put Brian back.
So Brian, if you're interested in Black Dog folklore, Mark Norman's book, Black Dog Folklore, very good.
I may be getting it, Brian, so I can, you know, let you know, because I'm sort of hooked on this now. This is what happens, and this is what is lovely about your book, about a lot of these books that center themselves around folklore, is that there's always the great list at the back that the author uses for research, which just expands your writing so much more. And, you know, there's always books mentioned in the story, or the person writing the introduction. It's why I ended up being a free range reader, because, you know, I can't have this list because I'm going to go here and there and, oh, that looks shiny over there. Right. And so it is nice. So Brian, or you can get the book and we can discuss it. Okay. At a later date. Today, we shouldn't have talked about that. So, Helen, we were talking about the themes and the idea that magic isn't always lovely and we should be prepared. when we're going up against it. One of the other themes, and as I mentioned before, also authors don't always agree with what I think the theme is, Brian. What I was looking at there is a time meshing. It's almost as if, you know, those in the story who didn't let go of the past or didn't even the group of individuals who I'm not going to name, none of them are happy with the way the traditions are working out, but nobody, that's the way it's always been done, right? And they won't let go of them. And so, and then other characters didn't know about the past or what was happening, but that information definitely helped them to a place, to be in the place they were supposed to be in the story. So, Helen, how do you feel about the past yourself? And is that a part of the story?
It's very, it's hard not to mention names as examples.
That's why this show is hard. Go ahead, it's your book. You can mention any names you want.
There's a lot to give away around there. But the past is a huge thing. And the moor is very much a liminal place for me. So it's a place where folklore and reality overlap. It's a place where past and present overlap. And I wanted to carry that through into the story. And a big part of my writing is that I don't want folklore to be lost. I want all of us to have an awareness of our mythic and our folkloric heritage, and be aware of these stories that our ancestors would have been familiar with and are very much there and ripe for us to relearn, reread, reinterpret, retell. And I just believe that's, it's such a healthy human function to engage with story, because story not only empowers us, it brings us together. And even, you know, folklore and myth, that it may be hard to prove whether it's true in the very hard sense of the word, it has a truth that is valuable.
Right, because it's a template of life, and you can find yourself in there. You can say, you know, I have a black hound in my life, or I have this in my life, you know, and just move it on. Story is everything. So, yes, it's very important.
You can find yourself in there. That's a really great description. I think I wanted to populate my book with characters and situations that were, you know, exciting and different, but also not so far away that you couldn't find yourself in there. So I know you mentioned Franz in your message.
Yes.
He doesn't come up much, so I'm kind of excited. He's in the background. So I'm excited that you brought him up.
But symbolically, he is so important because he, oh, gosh, it's sometimes important and difficult to get. He is important because his ties to the past are very real. And so when he sees things happening now that reflect upon that, it hurts his heart, because Franz has a good heart. He just was in the wrong times before, and you know, he feels like that's going to happen again. So I think he is just, I don't know, I've latched on to Franz now. Oh gosh, I can't tell you what to do with your book, but he better be I know you're gonna get rid of him, I just know it. And then, I'm not beyond sending messages at 2 o'clock in the morning to authors saying, once I have their email, no, what have you done? And they laugh wickedly like that, Helen. Okay.
He's already dead. Vaguely.
Oh, you know what? Don't try to just that. But he was, I do believe that part of him, maybe he would find happiness going back, because, you know,
Franz carries that small part of me and probably of a lot of people that hears the news and is waving their hands and going, please, we've been here before. Please, no, please stop. You know, that's That's him.
Yes, yes. Oh my goodness. I just realized he's like Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park. Don't do it. Bringing dinosaurs back is not a good idea. And here we go again with this. Yeah, I can. Okay. Mr. Griner says, Helen, you talk about Dartmoor as if it was were more than simply a place, either a nexus of possibilities or an entity in and of itself. Or have I misinterpreted it?
Oh, these are good questions.
Brian has good
questions. I mean, this is such a good one. I could talk a lot about this. And there's another amazing book, actually, by Knight. His second name is Knight, about like the sacred landscape of Dartmoor. And it's, you know, it's fascinating. So it's not just me. Dartmoor is this place that has been so heavily influenced by humans, even though it looks so wild and so desolate. There's ruins of Bronze Age hut circles everywhere. There's ruins of, you know, more modern tin mining. There's modern ruins of medieval farming settlements and field boundaries. There's just modern like farm buildings. There's the whole farmhouse that was used in Warhorse. That's a ruin on Dartmoor that they redid for the film. There's just so many signs of humanity's failure to tame Dartmoor, basically. But on the flip side, also, we have scarred it for life because the moor used to be oak woodland, much more like the little tiny section of Wisman's Wood that remains. And our activities have kind of made it the more open space it was. So Dartmoor, the history of the land and the history of humans on Dartmoor is just so perceivably entangled. I think that's what makes it a character in itself. Yeah, I think for me, the moor is a character in the book, and sometimes what you're hearing is the voice of the moor.
Well, I mean, isn't part of many, I'll say, original spiritualities of people or their indigenous belief system that the land does reflect what is happening with the people and vice versa? Like the land is a living being. It's not just something that you use or whatever. And so that would probably have applied to many of the people that were there. And that belief, I mean, when beliefs are strong, they can cut through time and things, don't you think?
Very much so. And I think many of us, probably if we're just sort of still and perceptive, when we see, you know, these massive granite outcrops of the tours on Dartmoor, and some of them have sort of weathered to look like a face. You've got Bowerman's nose, which is quite famous, which is in folklore. He was a huntsman who was turned to stone because he ran across the moor and disturbed a coven of witches. Never do that. But these rocks with faces in, I think our ancestors, you know, would have seen that and felt there was some kind of powerful entity there. And I think now we can still look at that and feel, you know, in the presence of something.
Right, right. Because it is amazing. And those stones sticking up, even if naturally, create such majesty, as you've put it. Even if you walk down the beach, I spend hours, I have a collection, and look at the little stones that are there. Like, what do they look at? We found goddesses and everything else that nature has carved. So, but it's definitely... I'm in love with it now, just from reading your book. And I've always had a thing for that kind of environment, you know, somewhere in August when everything is sunny and bright, I have to like turn on something from the 19th century that takes place on the moors, because I've had enough of this, you know, and we need to have some of that earthy soil kind of thing. So yeah, I can see how that would come through in the time. Okay, so I don't have a lot of hope for Franz. or maybe it is hope. It depends on how you look at that. So, here she goes. They are real people. I mean, I've known the characters in that book in several different, you know, people, and they do act real. And it's not like I'm going to, you know, you know a Mike, and you know he tells those stories, and you know there's something more to him, right? It can't be. He can't. He sees so much more, or he feels so much more. And, you know, I think we all kind of want to be Gemma, like loyal to our friends and, you know, ready to deal with what is. And I don't care how powerful you are magically, you're not going to cross my boundaries. Okay. So we have in this book, we have wonderful characters. The plot is nonstop. It is not ever boring, and it keeps you turning the pages. It does affect you physically with the chills and the sense and the, like, I am not going to walk out on those moors at night. Unless I'm Helen, who wrote the book in the first place. So it is just, and that was your first book. That was your first novel. So how old were you when you wrote that?
So when I started researching and writing the very start of that, I must have been in my early 20s. And that was, it was sort of like a 10 year, the first book took 10 years simply because the research and visiting all the places and, you know, properly collecting the information and then sort of the writing and editing. And then the second book was much quicker. So that took 2 years because I knew the area.
The most important question is, we know that you have to write a book for your thesis, so that has to come first. But this next book, are we looking at 10 years?
No. I had planned, I'm studying for my master's in creative writing at the moment, and I had planned to write my third book for my master's, but they're quite right when they said, you know, look, it's the third book in a trilogy.
It's all, you've already done it.
Yeah, you've done it. You need to do a fresh one. You know, just simply start a fresh book.
So have you started that fresh book?
Yes, I have. I am about 15,000 words into.
And are you going, is that the same kind of genre or?
Yeah, it's similar. It's more modern again, I'd say. It's still folklore, but it's more subtle. It's set in Cornwall. You've got the sea, and you've got, yeah, all of that. Some coastal folklore, but also there's an element of a journey. But it's folklore that has completely blended in to the modern world. So reading Heat of the Hunt, you might, you know, as they did, bump into the hunt master in disguise on the moor, but you'd still have a sense that something was a bit off. In the other book I'm working on, folklore has basically had to completely modernize and blend in order to survive.
So would you call it more of a magical realism?
Yeah, I think it's bordering into that, I would say.
I like that. Okay. So that's what's important, as long as I'm happy. What do we have to say, Brian? Helen, in terms of writing process, are you a pantser or a plotter? Do you prefer to write with pen and paper or computer?
I'm a little bit of both. So I'm a plotter, as in I'll write character arcs. So I'll write what a character needs to follow through the whole book and what they need to achieve. And then that will sort of intersect with another character. And then the other arc will intersect and intersect till you get a whole
strategy.
Web. Yeah. Because the characters very much drive the plot. And sometimes actually something that I might have wanted to happen, I realize the character wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Everybody says they take over.
They take over. So something can happen, like with Clara refusing to die, completely unexpected. That, you know, that was not planned. So I don't plan in, you know, precise detail. I will plan out the bones of a character arc and, you know, the bones of what the story needs to achieve. And then I will pants my way through fleshing that out. And I like to write on the computer because I know some people are amazing. They'll just write and write and write and write maybe 10,000 words in a day, you know, maybe more like 3,000.
Who are they?
Yeah, I don't know. I made that person up. Maybe 3,000. People write 3,000 words in a day. What I love to do, every time I come back to write, I edit the last section. So I'm very fiddly with how I do it. So I won't just write a whole draft and then write another draft. I will be editing every time I come back to the document. So I normally write only about 500 words in a day, but that'll be 500 words that's been edited a couple of times, and I'll edit the section before as well. So that's my method. It's slower, but it means that when I come to the end of the book, there's less editing.
Well, and it's the way that works best for you. And I think what we've all seen is that everybody is completely different with all of their, you know, their lives, but they're fitting around it and who they are as a person. So do you write a lot of background on your characters? Like back parts that we will never see in the book, but just to give you hints of who they are?
Sometimes. A lot of that will kind of be in my head and not necessarily written down. But I will tend to, I'll sort of jot down notes. I've got like a notebook and I might have pictures stuck in, and I might have extracts I've read about stuck in there as well. And there will always be, I think, yeah, that's a key thing of a good character. There's some things that I know that you're never going to know, that I'm never going to mention, that the character's never going to mention, that is a driving force, you know, in their subconscious. So, yes, but some of them are never coming out, I guess. They're staying in my head.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that a lot of what people write never sees the book. You know, they write it in their head, they write it, but it's important because it gives them an understanding of the things that do show up. It causes them to happen. So it is part of the writing process, if not part of the book itself.
Definitely.
So does that help, Brian? And also, I keep forgetting you can't answer back. I can't make writer's group this afternoon. I have some business to do, so, but I promise I'll be there next week. Okay. I am now using this show for personal messaging. So it saves on that. Now, I think you still have, I don't know if I should mention this. I think your book is still up for free.
No, it's ended.
Is it dead? Okay. I checked and I thought, is it? Does she want that mention? So
if you have Kindle Unlimited, the first book is free. Always, if you have Kindle Unlimited. The second book isn't on Kindle Unlimited. But yeah, you can get the first one for free. But if you don't have Kindle Unlimited, I think the Kindle edition of Heat of the Hunt is £1.99.
Oh yeah. No, it's well worth it. It's definitely, haven't I proven that yet? This book, it's amazing. So you know what? I think it is magical. I think you are magical because I start thinking about it and there's so many, it feels good despite the subject matter. And I wish you luck on the upcoming book. Now I want to read that one too. And of course we need to get that third one done. But are you going to stop at three? Like, I honestly think these characters could could survive a couple of more books. Like, there's lots, you know.
I was, you know, It's interesting you say that. I think it will be just the trilogy for this, but I could see some of the characters spinning off into their own.
Because they're sort of a Scooby group, but the monsters are real.
Yeah.
There's no ripping the mask off. You get what you see here. But no, they are very strong characters.
Who's your favorite one? Can you answer that? Is that an awful question?
What's that?
Who's your favorite character?
Oh, my gosh.
Sorry, that's a horrible
question. No. I honestly, I don't know if it's because he tells stories or because he's, like, I like Mike, okay? Because, you know, and he is, and then and despite everything, he comes through at the end, and, you know, he's not out of time. So I do like Mike because I could sit in a pub and he would tell me stories, okay? So that's what the thing. Just lovable Mike. I do like your protagonist. I mean, she's very real. So, you know, we don't go on with, she's just helping her friend. She gets annoyed. There are definitely layers there. She's not always perfect. Sometimes you're like, oh my God, why did you do that? But I mean, that is human, right? I think Clara is, you know, comedy, but also us in general, you know, anybody that's looked in or studied into these things or whatever has some, you know, or have they've met a Claire along the way.
We've all met her.
We know her. And she caused me to laugh, you know, I was reading to get it done because I wanted to finish the story and also because the show was upcoming. So I was reading late at night and I just burst out laughing at that line, and I was like, what's going on? And I'm like, never mind, you won't understand if I try to explain it to you, okay? You either get it or get it, go back to bed. So it was laugh out loud funny. I like them all. I mean, I find Adrian kind of annoying, but that's because I, you know, as so many 80s, he is meant to be annoying, right? So they all have, they're like a group. They're like a gang. Like, these people really fit together. And oh, now Brian wants you to write a story from Dartmoor's point of view. Like, ooh. You know. Now I'm thinking about that because you could really go back in history. You could really go back into the origins of the Wild Hunt and that from the lands. I mean, you could do anything, but I'm just saying.
On that, although weirdly, Brian, it's like you can read into my brain because I am actually in this weird crossover between writing and art. I'm having a piece of writing exhibited at an art exhibition in Bath, in the city of Bath, and the theme of the exhibition is Bath stone. So the extract of writing is printed so it looks like sedimentary rock, you know, as it settles and then becomes hard.
Very cool. Okay. I want a picture of that, or I will put it on Facebook later that week. That sounds amazing.
It is talking about how basically the place where we live, when we drink the water, the minerals from the stone literally come into us to make up our bones, and like we are the land. So I'm with you. I'm working my way into being the more.
Okay. Brian, you're impressing people today. Very good. Very well done. Okay. So yes. I am in such a good mood because this was such a good book and Helen is such a good sport. And so it's all just wonderful. We are going to have to say goodbye though. And send me those links. And
I'm going to send you some links.
Yeah. And anytime you got something in your head and you want to come back and chat, Helen, just give me a shout. Okay. You're in the family now. So, I have to have a chance to keep. Okay, write that third book. Okay.
I'm going to be writing my third book.
Yeah. We will be talking. Oh, he says it must be the lovely beer he's drinking. Stop drinking, Brian.
That's my beer.
Okay, if only the world were smaller, you know, we could just all find a patio together. Okay, you take care. Best
Thank
wishes
you so
with everything. And we'll talk to you later. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, that was fun. Heat of the Hunt. Helen R.R. Bruce. Fantastic, fantastic book. Because I was absent last week, the schedule's gotten a little confusing. So I'm not sure what we're doing next week. I could be Black Dogs. I don't know. So you guys have a wonderful week ahead. And until then, may your coffee be hot and your story sweet. Thanks for listening, everyone.